This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. President Obama signed the Affordable Care Act 4 years ago. It is still being implemented, and last month, a change in the Medicare system took effect that is fining hospitals the reimbursement money they get back for their services if certain patients are readmitted to a hospital within a 30-day period of their initial admission. Stephen O'Connell has more.
The Medicare Readmissions Reduction Program penalizes hospitals for three common causes of admission: congestive heart failure, pneumonia, and heart attacks. Congestive heart failure and pneumonia are the number one and number two reasons for admission and readmission in the country, respectively. Vice President of Financial Services at Wayne Memorial Hospital, Rebecca Craig.
Medicare recognized over many years that about 20% of all Medicare patients were readmitted to hospitals within 30 days. And so the thought was, if one in five Medicare admissions is a readmission, that the Medicare program could save money, and I'm sure their hope is that Medicare patients would get better treatment if Medicare could figure out a way to incentivize hospitals to try to minimize the number of patients that were readmitted within 30 days.
Hospitals and state entities in Eastern North Carolina are developing methods to improve the quality of care both in the hospital and out of the hospital. Education programs, state collaborations, and telehealth systems are some of the ways in which hospitals are trying to do that. The North Carolina Hospital Association, whose main mission is to advocate, educate, and lobby for hospitals, is helping. Vice President for Public Relations at the Hospital Association, Don Dalton, says that through initiatives such as Community Care of North Carolina, doctors are becoming leaders in improving healthcare practices.
The community care networks are made up of physicians, and so that makes them kind of the ideal people to be the lead in a regional context for this type of work.
When a Medicare patient goes into the hospital, Medicare gives the hospital a set payment for that specific diagnosis. Very often, hospitals' costs for treatment exceed the Medicare reimbursements. Through the Medicare Readmissions Reduction Program, hospitals may be encouraged to not make unnecessary diagnoses.
One of the things in our field that's been pointed out many, many times over the last 20 years is the variation of care, not only in hospitals but outside of hospitals, and that by standardizing care and learning what best practices are, we will not only reduce readmissions, but we would also have a tool to use to bring the cost of care down.
Vidant Medical Center in Greenville works in conjunction with ECU School of Medicine. According to the Hospital Compare website, Vidant has the same readmission rate as the national average. Physician at Vidant Medical Center and Assistant Professor of Cardiovascular Sciences at East Carolina University, Dr. John Cahill, treats chronic diseases like congestive heart failure.
We're proposing to set up chronic heart failure management programs throughout the entirety of the eastern half of the state, aided by the network, the Vidant network, so that we're really putting in place the protocols for heart failure management and facilitating local providers in providing high quality heart failure management locally and near where patients live.
Cahill says the heart management programs will help standardize care.
The support program is really to halt the progression of the disease or to try to reverse the progression of the disease with a combination of medication, potentially advanced therapies, and a great deal of education for the patient.
When asked about complications in developing standards of care, Dr. Cahill said access to patients was the biggest hurdle. Most of the programs for hospitals we talked to were centered on the idea of creating communication networks that can reach longer distances with more cost-effective results. Catherine Barmer is Outreach Services Coordinator at Carteret General Hospital in Morehead City. Carteret General also has the same readmission rates as the national average. To help lower the rates of readmission for their patients, Barmer has been using telehealth technology to monitor heart patients on a day-to-day basis.
The biggest obstacle is when you have to have that conversation with the patient that you're ready to be discharged from the program, because they don't, you know, they don't want to give it up. But I think it's that sense of security that there's someone there and watching you. And so I think from a patient satisfaction standpoint, it's been also very successful.
Carteret General's outreach program began in April. One of the first customers for the telehealth machine was Peter Flood. Flood had been into the hospital 3 times within a short period, and at the end of his 3rd visit, the staff asked him if he'd want to try a new at-home system. Flood left that day with the monitor and instructions.
If you answer the question, are you having trouble breathing, or do you feel more bloated, or are you having problems urinating or anything, have you taken your medicine, are you out of it? It's instantaneous almost. Within 10 minutes or 15 minutes, someone's calling you on the phone and saying, what kind of problem are you having? You know, and then advising you to call your doctor, you know, immediately.
Over the 5 months he used the machine, Flood learned how to closely monitor his body functions and how to better communicate with his physician.
I've learned that it is important to take your medications when you're supposed to take them, and at the rate you're supposed, and not skip any medications, which, you know, sometimes you have a tendency to do that. As I said, machine less, did you take all of your medications today? And if not, which ones did you, you know, and if you say no, they're going to call and ask you why you didn't take it.
Flood was on the program for the past 6 months. He finished just weeks ago. He says he wishes he could have kept the machine, but understands how it worked and how to behave as if he still has the assurance of the healthcare team at his fingertips. Catherine Barmer hopes to find more patients like Flood that can learn to act independently with the help of the machine. Along with the Medicare Readmissions Reduction Program, another Medicare program took effect on October 20th called the Hospital Value-Based Purchasing Program. Through a payment system, the program rewards hospitals that score high in 2 areas of care: improvement of clinical procedures, and the patient experience. Stephen O'Connell, Public Radio East.
This is the Down East Journal. Before Hurricane Sandy made landfall around New Jersey, New York, and Maryland, the National Hurricane Center declared it a post-tropical storm. According to the Insurance Journal, this prevents insurers from imposing pricey hurricane deductibles on storm-related claims. However, as Hurricane Sandy passed by North Carolina, it was still a hurricane, and North Carolina Department of Insurance officials say that has an effect on how deductibles are enforced. Residents living in eastern North Carolina are all too familiar with increasing deductibles and the rising cost of homeowners insurance. L.C. Morris has this.
Last month, a homeowners insurance rate increase request by insurance companies represented by the North Carolina Rate Bureau was denied by State Insurance Commissioner Wayne Goodwin.
By law, I had 50 days to review and scrutinize the filing. And after a thorough review by my experts and their recommendation, I decided that I would not approve the insurance company's request. I rejected it and told them that we would need to have a hearing.
Insurance Commissioner Wayne Goodwin felt the rates were unfair and excessive.
Not speaking specifically on this filing, but in general, there's always a question, a concern raised by the experts that work for me as to what factors have been considered, what math has been used to lead to the proposal insurance companies make, and what I stated in the notice of hearing was that it appeared that the rates being sought by the insurance companies were excessive, and it appeared that the rates being proposed by the insurance companies were unfairly discriminatory.
The filing proposed a rate increase of 17.7%, with some coastal counties seeing a proposed increase of 30%. Ray Evans is the general manager of the North Carolina Rate Bureau.
What we're trying to do is look at what happened, say, in 2010 and project what kind of claims would be paid in 2016. In that process, we do a lot of modeling. We try to develop trends What's the rate of inflation over that period of time? What are building costs going to do? The cost of plywood and lumber and those kind of things.
While commenting, Evans referenced Roger Pilkey, who is a professor of environmental studies and a fellow of the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences at the University of Colorado. Even with Hurricane Sandy and Hurricane Irene impacting the East Coast, Pilkey last month in the Wall Street Journal wrote that the United States is in a hurricane drought.
Our predictions are based on the historical record of hurricanes for the last 105 years or thereabouts. We see that this is a relatively inactive period. Since we are looking ahead 3 or 4 years in our rate making, we are suggesting that just in the normal range of statistical happenings, that storms are going to occur.
By law, insurance rates are set by territories. Eastern North Carolina is broken into 5 territories. Public comments on the rate increase request were held from October 3rd through the 19th. Commissioner Goodwin says about 9,000 people emailed or mailed comments.
In general, a filing of this nature, if it goes to a hearing, would go before the state insurance commissioner. The attorneys for the insurance companies would have their witnesses and their experts and their exhibits that they would present, and then the attorneys for the Department of Insurance and the people of North Carolina would also present their experts, their witnesses, and their testimony and their exhibits. This is not something that occurs in one day.
The last homeowners insurance rate increase was in 2008. Insurance companies requested a 19.5% statewide average increase, but a settlement of 4.05% was allowed.
It seems like it's every year, but actually it's about every 4 years. Homeowners insurance companies make their filings whenever they are ready to make them, and it might be every 3 or 4 or 5 years. If someone has had their rates go up in the interim, it's either been due to a legislative decision or by a decision that someone's own individual insurance company has made to reduce discount.
When it comes to premiums, Evans says insurance companies have to project, evaluate, and calculate.
One of the problems that we have is that the kind of the macro insurance formula is that the premiums that are required to be paid by policyholders are equal to the prospective losses plus the carrier's prospective expenses plus a profit. So it's a pretty simple formula. The problem is trying to identify what are prospective losses is problem number one.
The hearing is set for June 2013, but it could be further away before the hikes are implemented.
Even if we agree to accept whatever the decision is, it's going to be the end of the year before that really becomes finalized. Mechanically, carriers, it'll be difficult for them to notify policyholders and change their systems and do the things necessary to actually implement this thing until well into 2014. But if we think about a two-year cycle for making rates, we will still be issuing policies with those rates as late as April of 2016.
For information on a variety of insurance-related topics, visit the North Carolina Department of Insurance website at ncdoi.com. I'm L.C. Morris.
The Downeast Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with the North Carolina Symphony Holiday Pops Concert in Jacksonville at Northside High School Auditorium, Sunday, November 25th at 3 p.m. Enjoy holiday classics under the direction of William Curry. Ticket information at 910-455-9840. Since human existence, people have been making music using the materials they have lying around. One of the earliest instruments was a flute, carved from hollowed-out bird bones and mammoth ivory. It was carbon-dated to be 42,000 years old. The tradition of using recycled items to create instruments still continues today. David English, owner of Black Owl Guitars in New Bern, is using old license plates, peanut can lids, and old cigar boxes to build guitars.
It has a real nasty sound. It's almost a gritty, dirty sound. But it's also, I think that gritty, dirty sound is it's very authentic. for the times and the traditions that music comes out of. It's very Americana.
English has played the six-string guitar for 14 years, learning other instruments along the way. Although he doesn't use a paintbrush, he still considers himself an artist.
You know, I write songs and make music, and I'm trying to introduce people to a type of music that existed, you know, 100 years ago. And I think in that, I guess a little bit of a historian as well.
The very first cigar box instrument is documented in an 1860s newspaper. The picture shows two Civil War soldiers sitting next to a tent, and one of them is playing a cigar box fiddle. After the war, English says these homemade instruments started gaining in popularity.
A lot of slaves would go to socializations and things. These are folks that couldn't afford instruments. They would build their own. It kind of comes out of old jug bands and things like that. And the cigar box guitar is born. And then through the 20s and 30s, where we have the Great Depression, people couldn't afford their instruments. Folks like B.B. King, you know, his dad built him a cigar box guitar because he can afford. And that's where he started. And everybody knows who B.B. King is.
Jimi Hendrix, Carl Perkins, Ted Nugent, and Buddy Guy are just a few of the famous musicians that have played cigar box guitars. English says his interest in building and playing cigar box instruments started 2 years ago when surfing the web.
A guy was building this cigar box guitar, but he just strung it up with nylon string. It making not a lot of noise, but it kind of intrigued me. I was kind of like, I wonder if somebody's ever tried that with real guitar strings.
Another quick internet search, and English found that his idea was already a reality.
Tons of people building cigar box guitars and building cookie tin banjos and steel lap guitars out of old wooden ironing boards and playing with shot glasses. And it opened up this whole new world. And I said, you know what? That's where I want to be. This combines two of the things I like most is music and building stuff.
English builds each guitar by hand in his garage workshop in River Bend. He uses mostly recycled materials, wood scraps from a local carpenter, old bottle caps, and recycled bolts.
When I first started, I went to the tobacco store. I guess you can go to a tobacco store and get a cigar box. And so I went up there, and that a guy was, you know, having empty boxes from the humidor, and so I just bought them for a couple bucks a piece. But as people found out I was building, and other people started wanting instruments, sometimes now I come home and there's a bag of them on my front doorstep.
It's with these cigar boxes that both guitars and music are created. Earlier this week, when I visited English's workshop, he was building a diddly bow.
You know, that's where, like, the original handmade guitar. A lot of guys built diddly bows back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. They were stringing broom wire to a 2x4 in a barn or something. It's just one string and you use a slide.
The first step is carving a groove in the box for the neck to go through. The neck for this diddly bow is a piece of wood from a farm in Vanceboro.
This is where they used to hang tobacco with up in the tobacco barns. They would strap it on here, and it would hang up in there to dry.
English used a combination of power tools and hand tools to construct the diddly bow. Instead of a wooden soundboard like the typical six-string acoustic guitar, the cigar box guitars employ a resonator to help create that unique bluesy sound. The resonator on this particular diddly bow was an old paint can lid. On some of the instruments English makes, he installs pickups that capture the mechanical vibrations of the strings and turn them into an electrical signal that can be put through an amplifier. Once the electronics are installed inside the cigar box, the instrument will be ready for staining. For this process, English uses mud from the Trent River.
If I take mason jars and scoop the black mud, you know, that everybody knows stains everything. And so I'll let it sit however long, however dark I want it to be, and let it sit in the mud and wipe it down. And those softer parts of the wood where the grain is, especially on some of the maples and stuff, really pick up that dark look. And you can see the grain of the wood really nice. I think it gives it a very vintage look.
Instead of a polyurethane finish, English says he uses a natural protectant, beeswax, collected from his friend's beehives in Pamlico County. Whether it's a cigar box guitar or a diddly bow, English says each instrument is unique in the way it sounds and especially in the way it looks. Take the Carolina Cruiser, for example.
The Carolina Cruiser is a... We have a Don Thomas cigar box with a license plate for the resonator and hardware bolts for your nut and your bridge. And then I thought it was only appropriate for the volume knob is a Pepsi cap. I mean, here we are in North Carolina. You got to have the Pepsi cap on there.
You can see a picture of guitar maker David English and his recent creation, the Carolina Cruiser Cigar Box Guitar, when you visit our website, publicradioeast.org. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. There on the dock stands the ghost of a man preaching hell in a starched white shirt.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. As the sunlit part of the days continues to get shorter, and it gets cooler and cooler each afternoon, it's a good time to start thinking about the fact that the warmth of spring will be here before we know it. And there's one wonderful way to guarantee a bright, colorful spring right now, and that's by planting bulbs. Yes, November and early December is the perfect time to plant bulbs in coastal North Carolina. First, let's talk about where and how to plant bulbs. With very few exceptions, all bulbs want good drainage. In other words, they don't want to be in a wet area where they might rot. So choose a well-drained area or build a raised berm for planting your bulbs. Soil pH is also very important for bulbs. The planting area should be in the 6 to 6.8 range if possible. How do you know your soil pH? Well, you go to your local Cooperative Extension Service office and get a free soil test box and information sheet. You follow the instructions, send the sample to Raleigh, and your results come back. Analyze perfectly for our part of the country and for your particular soil. And it will include not only the pH, but also information about the nutrients available in your soil. You then can decide whether you want to plant your bulbs in large sweeps. That's a beautiful way to plant bulbs, big masses of bulbs that come up all at once, or nestled between other plants that will still be quiet and dark in the early spring to bring bright bits of color. You can plant them almost anywhere in your yard where you have the right pH and well-drained soil, but think through how your garden looks in the spring and choose the spot where the bulbs will accent beautifully. Prepare your soil by incorporating some well-rotted organic matter and some slow-release fertilizer. That should be worked into the soil at planting time. Then plant bulbs about 2 to 3 times the depth as the bulb is in size. That means that most small bulbs are only planted 3 to 4 inches deep, but larger bulbs, like daffodils, can be planted down to 8 inches deep. Water the area thoroughly after you plant the bulbs, and then put a mulch over the top to help keep down weeds. All right, now you know how to prepare the soil area and where to plant the bulbs, but which bulbs should you plant? Well, there's a wide range of choices. But just adapt your expectations to the bulbs that you choose. Some bulbs that will come back year after year as perennials in other parts of the country will only be an annual here, meaning they will come back 1 year. Sometimes you might get a second or third year, but that's just a bonus. Don't count on it. If you're looking to plant tulips and crocus, snowdrops, or dwarf iris, many of those are simply going to be annuals. A lot of people get quite unhappy after buying expensive tulip bulbs and planting them here, and then finding they're not going to come back year after year. But there are many bulbs that will come back and perennialize. Those are things such as daffodils. They do beautifully here, and they come in many different varieties and colors. Some bloom early in February and are shorter. Those would be varieties like Jack Snipe and February Gold. Others are larger and taller and bloom a little later. Carlton and St. Cavern are a couple of varieties. You can plant paper whites or jonquils. Sweetness, quail, baby moon, minnow, all of those will do well here. Spanish bluebells do well, as do summer snowflakes. So it's a wonderful time to think about bringing color to your spring. And don't think just about yourself. It's a wonderful time to be thankful for neighbors and friends and family who also enjoy their gardens, or maybe who you can teach to enjoy their garden. Give them some bulbs and plant them for them, and they'll think of you in the spring. I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving dinner, and I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.